This is Ed Epley, and I'm joining Derek Champagne today to talk about my new book called Let's Be Clear, The Six Disciplines of Focused Management Pros.
Welcome to the Business Leadership Series, where we engage with leaders who are making an impact on their worlds and who want to share their knowledge and experience for your personal and professional growth. The following interview is designed to inspire you to become the best leader you can be. Your host, Derek Champagne, is the founder and CEO of The Artist Evolution, a full-service agency building successful brands, marketing tools, and campaigns, and also the author of the best-selling book, Don't Buy a Duck. And now, let's begin today's Leadership Series interview.
Welcome to the Business Leadership Series, where our goal is to inspire you to become the best leader that you can be. We have Ed Epley with us today. He's a leading global expert in professional management, sales strategy, and performance management, a principal consultant for The Table Group, a Patrick Lencioni company, and operates the Epley Group. He's trained managers at multinational companies across the U.S., Europe, China, Japan, Australia, and his clients include a who's who in the business category leaders such as BMW, DSW, Sara Lee, Bloomberg, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, Speedway, Steamboat Ski and Resort Company, Value City Furniture, PSA Airlines, Emerson Electric, Satellite Auto Glass, and many others. And today we're going to be talking with him about some leadership strategies and his upcoming book, Let's Be Clear, Six Principles of Focused Management Pros. Ed, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Derek. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hey, I'd like to start so our guests get to know you a little bit. Kind of give us a little bit about your background. Start as early on as you want and then how you got to where you are today. And then I'm going to dig in and I'm chomping at the bit to ask you some leadership questions and hear about your book.
Well, I will tell you that I didn't realize for quite some time that I was an entrepreneur at heart, a serial entrepreneur. But if you look back at my life, I started raising hogs as a 4-H project when I was 11 or 12 and turned it into a business and started selling breeding stock to local farmers when I was 14 and 15. Yeah. And subsequently then started businesses in the advertising business and manufacturers rep businesses, the training business for Dale Carnegie with their franchises, and finally a call center for setting appointments for professional services companies. So all along the way, I suspect what I found out or knew was I'm better working for myself than I am for somebody else.
So talk to me about leadership. I mean, you've got a great track record for helping the who's who of businesses and leadership. For you, what makes a great leader?
I think one of the major components is authenticity. You know, there's a lot of prescriptive recipes for what it takes to be effective as a leader. I find that the leaders that I think of as being the best at their leadership capabilities are authentic in the sense that they don't try to be somebody other than who they are. And one of the components of authentic leadership, I think, is the ability to demonstrate courage in a variety of situations. You know, if you talk to folks who've placed themselves in harm's way, they talk about courage is not the absence of fear, but the ability to act despite it. And I think that it's so easy for people to not act when they're in charge of a team or a department or an organization. And so I think that the authenticity and courageous behavior are go hand in hand in my definition. I also think they're great at creating clarity so that people know what's expected and know what to focus. I think that leaders also that are highly effective get true committed behavior from people, both their direct reports, but throughout the organization. So that they get that discretionary effort that otherwise does not have to be offered up. And then the last thing is they create energy in the organization. They create a sense of urgency that's not artificial, that people are excited to do the work that needs to be done.
I love that. Authenticity, courage, clarity, and focus get true committed behavior and create energy and urgency. Great advice. So you've talked about a good leader. What are some symptoms of poor leadership?
Well, I've identified what I think are probably six that tend to be, you know, maybe the disproportionate ones. I think there are probably more, but one is the good talent that you have will depart. They'll leave you. You know, the folks that really are your best players are the ones that are going to have always someone knocking on the door or calling them or emailing them about opportunities. And so those people will start to listen and start to act on those invitations. The idea that if you're growing, you're probably not growing profitably. And a lot of times it's one and or the other. So the organization's not going to be sustainable. Productivity is usually declining or flat. And then morale is at best tepid. You know, it's people may not actually be cynical, but they're probably not excited about what the organization's about. I think a couple others is that there's little to no bench strength because people are too busy doing the work that should be done by others and not leading. And then the inconsistency of results. If you think about great leadership, they perform time and time again. I don't care what endeavor it happens to be. You know, they may not win the championship in athletics every year, but they compete every year. They have to be taken serious. And I think in business, if you're not a great leader, you might do it 1 year, but then you have to take 2 or 3 years to retrench and get yourself back to where you can compete again. So those 5 or 6 things is, I think, are signs of leadership that's in question.
I'm going to wait to jump into this question, but I'm dying to know some ways to improve leadership. But let's keep going first. You talk about this, a stop doing list. What does that mean?
Well, Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great, makes reference to the most important list any executive can make is the stop doing list. And so often you see organizations that have 6 or 8 strategic objectives. And I would submit that it's not wrong to try to work in those that number of areas, Derek. But I think what happens if you don't declare one of those as most important, then you're probably going to get confusion and frustration. And so in order to be able to have time to work on what truly is most important, you got to make sure you don't spend time on things that don't really matter. Or if they don't get worked on, it's not going to be as damaging to the organization. So somehow the leader in a team or a department or in a company, I think routinely, if at least once a year, should be asking the organization, what are things that we should stop doing at least temporarily to see if they continue to, you know, still have value or not. And the only way you're going to find out is if you stop doing them. See if somebody complains, a customer or a vendor or somebody internally that says, I need that as an input to produce the output that you expect of me.
And is this doing unnecessary processes in the company, or are you thinking serial entrepreneurs? I mean, myself, I had so many things going on. I had a consultant in 2016 say, Derek, 2017 is the year of no for you. And I had to strip things back, and I saw traction when I did that because I had much better focus on the things were important. What are you talking about when you say pull some things back in the organization to see if it affects the organization or not?
First of all, I appreciate that you've been through that process and you can relate to the fact that it actually provides benefits. So thank you for sharing that with our audience.
Well, I'm in recovery. Yes.
Aren't we all? I think so many times there's, I hope this doesn't get too convoluted. And if it doesn't make sense, stop me and I'll try to make it simpler. Sure. But if you think about it, so many people define their jobs in terms of activities they do rather than results that they should be producing from those activities. And I don't blame the individual. I blame the boss if that's happening. But if you go then to an individual who was hired to, in their mind, to do these activities, and you say, stop doing those activities, you'll often hear them say, I can't, that's my job. Hmm. And so first of all, they've not been educated to the fact that they're in business, their job exists to produce some outcome that the business values or that customers value. And instead, they define it in doing an activity. And so, first of all, you got to recognize that that goes on. Now, as the business changes, as the market changes, and those activities that produced a result in the past may no longer be needed by the marketplace. So what was valuable 2, 3, 5, 8 years ago, when if you keep doing it today, somebody doesn't value it. That's now been replaced by something else as being more important. But the person who's actually doing that activity, no one's ever told them that it doesn't add value. And so that's why you have to stop doing things and test it sometimes to find out if anybody actually misses it. In the book, I make reference to a client that I did work with at the time, had about 6 or 7 people who did nothing but generate reports monthly that went throughout the organization. And this is in the back of the day when those reports were actually generated in paper, if you remember the large punch paper that would go out in those binders kind of thing. And they needed those people to help install contracts that were recurring revenue, and they were growing so fast that they weren't getting those contracts implemented. So they said, you folks who do nothing for reports, stop doing those for temporarily for the next 90 days, start helping us implement these contracts. And if somebody comes to you and asks for one of the reports that you've been building and putting together, then help them get it. But right now, we're not going to worry about doing it unless somebody asks for it. And of all the work and all those reports that were being generated, they only had two requests in 90 days.
Wow.
And so they had a number of people whose full-time job was creating reports that in the past were valuable, but, you know, fast forwarding 2-5 years, no longer were, and no one stopped to tell them that you don't have to do that.
I love that. I love the mentality, too. I love the mentality of the stop doing. That makes sense. Thanks for that explanation. I'll tell you, for my personal leadership, I had a health scare a while back where I had a day off where I was in the hospital for a day, and everything was great. But I looked at my list and said, okay, what do I need to clear off my schedule? And I looked and I thought, you know what? There's a lot of things here that I don't have to be doing right now. So what am I doing in my day intentionally as a leader to make sure that I'm moving the needle and being as impactful as I can? So I get that from a personal standpoint, and that makes sense for the business as well, to make sure that everything is running efficiently.
Well, there's probably a corollary to this. If you just if you think about it, most people are at their most productive about the 24 to 48 hours before they go on an extended vacation. And it's because they have the capacity in that time period of 24 to 48 hours to say no to so many things and just do the critical few things that really matter in that time period. And most of us, there's a term that you should hardly ever use in business, I think it really applies to our own behavior with regard to our use of our time, is we need to be ruthless.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about, I want to go into leadership now. You talked about great leadership, authenticity, mm-hmm. courage, clarity, focus, true committed behavior, energy, urgency, poor leadership, best people are leaving, not growing profitably, flat productivity, tepid morale, not excited, no bench strength, inconsistent results. So my personal story, and I share this on our commercials for our radio show, is that I woke up a few years ago and realized that not only am I a leader, but I'm an unintentional leader. One of my quests for having this show is to learn from experts like you. So how do we get better? If we see ourselves in that poor leadership category and we go, well, I want to be those things, but what are some steps I take to get there?
Well, I think that there's some questions that I make reference to in the leadership area in the book. And this, at least symptomatically, I think, could identify where a person ought to spend their time. So what's an area of the business where more courage would be beneficial, or where people want me to be courageous? And for example, most businesses have what we call that destructive hero, that high-performing jerk, it's not jerk that goes in there, but for the purposes of our audience, I'll say that. So most of the people in the organization are waiting for us to have the courage to say we will not tolerate that kind of behavior, no matter how good the results are. I think that another area where most folks have not done much grunt work to be a great leader is to create a purpose beyond making money that will serve to unite people and let them put their own personal interest secondary to achievement of this purpose. So one of the things that Patrick Lencioni really emphasizes is that most great teams are fighting for something. They're fighting for something beyond making money. And when that purpose serves to unite them, then politics and pettiness and selfishness tends to get way, way down in the hierarchy of what people use to make their decisions, and instead they tend to be more unified and more worried about what do I need to do to make this purpose happen and become a reality, regardless of how it affects me and my department personally. I think those are a couple of things. I think that, in the book, or even I guess probably the self-awareness that we talk about is probably pretty crucial. So if I want to become a more effective leader, I probably need to start to understand what am I really good at and what am I really not good at, and not based upon my own opinions, but truly based upon some professional observation by somebody who doesn't have a horse in the race and telling me whatever they tell me. Yeah. So I would also start to try to get that clarity about the strengths and weaknesses that I possess. And I Derek, I know you're younger than me because almost everybody is. But what I've learned way too late in my own career is what I do that most people really value. And I think most of us have an opinion about what that is, but I don't think most of us have that really clarified. So as a result, we start to behave and do things because we think it's what people value, but we really don't know what it is. Hmm. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It does. And I think I agree with you. I think self-awareness is so important in identifying your strengths and weaknesses and being open to improving and always looking and always being willing to look at yourself first. I mean, we have challenges in our organization. I'm learning to say, well, you know, as a leader, is that because of me? Am I responsible for some of that? And a lot of times I am. Either a behavior that's been allowed or it's been an assignment of management, but it does stop with me. And I do think that's great for a leader to be self-aware and be willing to take responsibility too.
Yeah. And, you know, I find that entrepreneurs fit into one of two categories. I think they tend to be disproportionately in the camp of either they're so hard on themselves that they don't want to admit they have any strengths. You know, so they're in this idea that they everything they're doing is built on a smoke and mirrors kind of foundation, that there's no substance to it when that's not true at all. So they think they're just nothing but weaknesses. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have those that they're just their confidence borders on or is actually arrogance to the point that the rules that apply to others don't apply to them.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I've heard it described as the imposter complex.
Where
some of the greatest performers out there a lot of times in arts, comedy, and feel like they're an imposter and have a hard time even getting on the stage. And they're some of the most brilliant minds that we know.
Yeah.
The Robin Williams types.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's great. So this all kinds of brings back to me the culture and how it affects the culture. So, and I know you talk about culture. You say there's two sets of rules, written versus unwritten. Can we take a few minutes and talk about culture?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, depending upon the size of the organization, there's companies and entities that spend a lot of time and energy working on culture, and there's those that don't. But regardless, organizations do have cultures. I don't care, you know, every family, every couple, every unit of people, whatever kind of organization that they tend to have, there's a culture that goes with that. So those are the written and the unwritten rules for how we will behave. And when I do the work that I do in the course for presidents that I teach at Aileron, we talk about you either have a culture in your company by design or you have it by default. So the written and unwritten rules tend to be the employee handbook will be the written rules, which tends to be written for the people who need thou shalt nots. You know, so they're the 3 to 5% of people who will take liberties that no one else will take just because they are that kind of person. I think of George Costanza in the Seinfeld episode that slept with the cleaning woman and said, if somebody told me I shouldn't, I wouldn't have, you know, kind of a thing.
Right.
And so the employee handbook's for that person. But most people don't need that. What they need and what they pay attention to are the unwritten rules for what the boss does, for what the owner does, that indicates what really they value. And I think most of us tend to pay more attention to what the boss does, what she or he does when there's a mistake or a problem, when there's failure. And they see how that gets addressed, you know, either fairly or quickly or poorly, or, you know, there's courage or there's not courage, there's indictments without evidence, those kinds of things. So I think the behavior that we, and when we're in executive or ownership or leadership position, the behavior we exhibit when there's a failure or a mistake, I think really just sends all these signals that go so far into how willing people are to, you know, first of all, admit a mistake, willingness to take a risk. You know, everybody says they want their people to take risks in appropriate ways and times and places. But in fact, so many times we exhibit behavior that says, we don't want you to do that. You know, we're just not comfortable with you, you know, thinking for yourself. And I really feel like most owners don't understand the size of the shadow. Most presidents, most CEOs don't understand the size of the shadow they cast on the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sobering. It really is. Wow. That's a responsibility.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of us, when we get into our leadership roles, whether it's an owner or, you know, an executive, a lot of us didn't sign up for that.
Yeah.
We didn't understand that that's part of the job and that's part of the responsibility. And you know, there were some other things we wanted probably, and not just the salary or the title, but we wanted some of the responsibility, the scale of the job as attractive to us. But we didn't understand there were these other things that really make a huge difference about the amount of a commitment and loyalty people are going to give us.
Yeah, and I can tell you personally, I did not expect those things. I pride myself in being a serial entrepreneur that like to build things, but I really like to build it and then see what I could make happen with it. But, maybe not the day-to-day leadership things where you're casting a shadow and there's that responsibility. Wow. And it's been a few year journey for me to be more intentional with that, but it is a responsibility. Can you talk to me, what's a sign that a leader has a green thumb for growing people?
First of all, the whole premise of growing people rests in the premise that I have, that your job exists to produce results, grow people, keep marginal performers uncomfortable, and to make things better. So if you put that in the backdrop, okay. when we talk about growing people, it's the improvement in their personal productivity year over year. That's at the most fundamental level of what I mean when we talk about growing people. So when we talk about a manager's job of growing their people, it's not necessarily preparing them for advancement as much as it is getting them to be more effective, more productive in their job year over year. And so that means I have to actually think about, if you put it in baseball terms, since we're in the springtime, it's really about how do I improve their batting average, right? How do I improve their fielding average so that with the same number of opportunities, they more successfully convert those opportunities either into a hit or an out, depending upon whether it's offense or defense. And so, you know, do I need to improve their speed? Do I need to improve their eye-hand coordination? Do I need to improve their strength? Whatever it is, but there's a competency that goes with that improvement in productivity. And so now I, as the boss, have to help my people identify what one thing, if they make a slight change in that, usually it's not a you know, radical change. It's just, it's a slight difference, more patience or, you know, more urgency or whatever it happens to be in a given situation that yields a better result than I'd otherwise would get. So I'm not getting any more opportunities than I have historically. It's not an effort thing. It's just that with the effort that I'm expending, I get a better result. You know, you hear that trite saying of work smarter, not harder. It's really about perform at a higher level. That's really what we mean by that. I'm asking you to elevate your game, and I'm not telling you to work harder. What I am saying is I want you to be more a craftsman of your practice or the kind of work that you do, whatever it is. That's a long-winded answer, but I want people
answer.
To understand. Well, thank you. I just want people to understand it's not necessarily preparing me to advance, although that should ultimately be a possibility. But everybody in my team has to get 3 to 5% better every year. So when we talk about growing people, people have a green thumb. They recognize that. They do that with everybody. Productivity should be rising year over year if we're doing this. If you think about it, the output of the business should get better every year. And a lot of times what you see is productivity rises for a period of time and then it plateaus, because sometimes people's capacity to do the job reaches a limit. What the job needs from them, they're no longer capable of doing. So that does happen. In other cases, people want to arrive. They don't want to have to keep getting better. I don't think there's anything unusual about the idea that at some point after 10 or 15 years, I think a pretty normal human tendency to say, I'd like to coast a little bit.
Absolutely.
But that's not the world we live in. The harsh business reality that we operate in is that if we're not getting better as an organization, then our competitors are either catching up or passing us.
Right. Coasting is declined now. It is.
It absolutely is.
Man, Ed, thank you so much. Great advice. We've got just a couple more minutes, and I want to focus on your book for a few minutes. Tell us about the book, and then give us kind of the premise, and then I'd also like to know, I always like to know, what can the reader expect to take away?
First of all, the book came as an outreach, or I guess you should say an outcome of people asking me for more details when I would work with them either at Aileron or work with them in my own consulting work that I do. And so they'd say, well, do you have more, you got more information about that specific topic, or what else do you, I want some more from you, whatever that might be. And so I recognized there was this need or demand. And then the second thing was, after 40 years in business, I was thinking, you know, I probably ought to write some of this stuff down because it's all up in my head. And so it was really an effort to codify what I have. But I struggled for a couple of years, Derek, to come up with a framework for it. And fortunately, I started doing work at Aileron in Tip City, Ohio, which is this entrepreneurial center created by Clay Mattil, the former owner of Iams Pet Foods, to help executives learn how to professionally manage their businesses. And so as I started to learn their model for professional management, all of a sudden I recognized here's a way using their six disciplines to, if you will, as a skeleton, to hang on that the things that I've learned about each of those disciplines that others could perhaps use. Mm-hmm. So that's how the book came about. The audience for the book, the target for the book, really is owners, CEOs, presidents. And if they find it worthy, then what I'd really like for them to do is to share that and, you know, hand copy to the people that they have directly reporting to them so that they can have a common language to talk about the different situations that they experience. So that when we say the word leadership, that we have a common definition of it and a common framework. If we talk about strategy, we're looking at it from the same point of view, or culture or structure, whichever the disciplines we're talking about. Because I think, Derek, you experience that even in the people that you interview, that when somebody says strategy, there's a wide range of meaning to that, depending upon who you speak with and what their experiences have been. So part of what the intent of the book was is to create a common vocabulary for the organizations that would choose to read the book.
A couple books that we've done that something similar with. One was Deep Work by Cal Newport, where our team was able to get on the same page about what work means and what deep work means. Another one was A 12-Week Year, where our team was able to be on the same page on how we're doing our cycles, how we're doing our KPIs. And I'm excited about reading this book as well and seeing if that's another language that we can speak together, because it's been company changing for us to implement those books together and see our we saw one guy spotted on a Saturday morning in a Starbucks just independently reading the Deep Work book, just to come together with our team. So I love it. I can't wait to read yours. Let's be clear, six disciplines of focus management pros. So excited about that. Ed Epley, thank you again for being our guest. Where can we find your book? And it's coming out soon. When is it coming out, and where can we look for it now?
It's actually out now on Amazon, so people can go there and get it. And they can also get it at the epleygroup.com. So my last name, E-P-P-L-E-Y, the epleygroup.com. They can also go online there, and it'll connect them to Amazon directly to the webpage for that.
Awesome. Ed, thank you again for being our guest, and we look forward to reading this book and then watching the next great things that you're doing out there.
Thanks, Derek. I'd love to visit with you anytime.
Awesome. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Business Leadership Series, where we engage with leaders who are making an impact on their worlds and who want to share their knowledge and experience for your personal and professional growth. This interview was designed to inspire you to become the best leader you can be.